Okay, my computer shows 8:31, so everyone else who's coming in will have to miss the first couple of seconds, but they can pick it up what they miss on YouTube. By the way, someone pointed out to me, I didn't know those who are listening on YouTube, you can actually speed it up. So you can listen at 1.5 speed, 2 speed, whatever, if you want. So there you go. Okay, let's get right into it. I don't have any, a number of people emailed me, but nothing I want to respond to online. I want to pick up, we're going to finish up with Or HaChaim, which is the first section of the book, and we'll even move into Yoredeia. We're up for those who are following. Siman Lamed Aleph, so 31. Let me introduce you to the question and then the how I came to it, and then the individual, and take you to Yemen. And a little bit about what's the Jewish history of Yemen. First, let me pull up my screen here. The question is, are frozen etrogim good from year to year? That is, you take an etrog and you freeze it, deep freeze, let's say, could you use it the following year? So where did I come up with such a question? Believe it or not, it was inspired by this individual, Salomon Freehoff. Salomon Freehoff, an American reform rabbi, he's not like, I mean, for many years in Pittsburgh, by the way, at Rodef Shalom, he's not like the great reform scholars who had their background in Orthodox institutions. His whole life is in the reform movement. And what made him special is that he was an expert on the responsa literature. They say he had the largest private collection of responsa in the world. Responsa are, you know, halacha questions and answers. What we're doing right now, the first half of it is responsa. And this would be, I have to look where Harvard or Hebrew University catalogs this volume, because responsa are cataloged by a certain number and then Library Congress numbers. I'm not sure what they'll do. But he was an expert in the responsa literature. Not only was he an expert, he also was the halachist of the Reform movement. What does that mean to be a halachist of the Reform movement? They don't accept halacha. Well, as the title of this book about him, you see this mentions about if things on the side you can't see, you can play around with the pictures. You can move them on top. You can get rid of my picture. You can do all sorts of things. But the title of this book, let me click on it so you can see it maybe better, is Guidance, Not Governance. Salomon B. Freehoff from Reform Responsa. So Freehoff's attitude was that we have 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years of responsa. We're not throwing it out just because we're Reform Jews. It provides guidance for us, but it doesn't control what we do. Now, Freehoff, in addition to writing numerous volumes of responsa in our time, all these different responsa, probably 10 volumes for answering questions of Reform rabbis who wanted to really do things in accord with the Jewish tradition when it didn't violate conscience or things like that. He also wrote two excellent volumes out of print for many years now. One is called The Responsa Literature, which is a history of responsa. And the other is called A Responsa Treasury, where he translated many of the famous responsa into English, and you can he leaves out the halachic argumentation, but you can read these responsa, which are very important historical sources. He had a lot of help, by the way. There was a rabbi in Pittsburgh named Wolf Leiter, or Zev Wolf Leiter. We'll come back to him later in these classes. But he was a big rav and a posek, and he was very friendly with Freehoff. There was a time, especially before World War II, where Orthodox rabbis, Gedolei Yisrael, had relationships with non-Orthodox rabbis. That's the theme, of course, of my little book, Sol Liebman Orthodox, but it wasn't really such a problem. Samuel Belkin was very friendly with a Reform rabbi in Providence. I believe he even stayed with him when he would go to Brown. Wolf Leiter, he's even mentioned in the introduction to some of Freehoff's volumes. We'll see later what Rav Soloveitchik thought about this relationship, or at least what it said. Even though Rav Soloveitchik himself had a very close relationship with a conservative rabbi named Joseph Shubo. And when all the Orthodox rabbis were going after Soloveitchik, they were his big opponents. in the Kashrus scandals. They wanted to put him out of business. They wanted to put him in jail, even some of them. It was Dafka, a conservative rabbi, Rabbi Joseph Shubo, who stood up for Rav Soloveitchik, and of course the judge in the case was Jewish, and it's because the Rav had such a friendship and a good relationship with Shubo. You have to read the letter that he sends to the congregation, the conservative congregation, when he was invited to come to the synagogue to honor Rabbi Shubo, and he, how can the Soloveitchik, go to the conservative synagogue? It's a bit of a problem. So he writes this wonderful letter in the volume published by Natty Huffcott explaining that his not going to the synagogue should not be taken as a sign that he doesn't admire Rabbi and Mrs. Shubo, et cetera, et cetera. But so this is Solomon Friedhoff. So what does this have to do with the question? Well, many years ago, I read a review of one of his volumes of responsa by the late Louis Jacobs. And Louis Jacobs says that he finds it strange, which I find it strange, I think you'll find it strange too, that here the Reform movement doesn't accept basic things. Obviously, we know Shabbos and Kashrus, but remarriage without a get. What's more important than getting a get if you're married? And yet the Reform movement just says, that doesn't matter. We don't need to have, we're married by the rabbi, but you get divorced, doesn't matter. We go by the civil marriage. So Jacob said it's more than a little strange that Solomon Friedhoff doesn't care and throws out the whole idea of marriage and divorce, which are basic to Judaism, and yet he takes very seriously and has a whole response to him about whether you can use a frozen netrog. Well, I thought that was an interesting question too, and interesting as well, but I thought the question was also interesting. A frozen netrog, never heard of it. So when I was in Harvard my first year, I came across the sefer of this rabbi. His name is Yitzhak Ratzabi. He's in Bnei Brak today. He's a Yemenite. By now, there's three volumes of Olat Yitzhak. In fact, the tshuva we're looking at was published in volume two, but I only saw one volume. And immediately, I was attracted to him and his writings for the simple reason, first of all, we don't have much in the way of Yemenite responsa. In Yemen, they didn't either. They didn't choose to write, or they didn't know how to write. Their response are like two lines. Here you have Rav Ratzabi writing lengthy response. But what really caught my eye was that even though he's a Yemenite and was educated in Ashkenazi yeshivas, I think he even went to Kol Torah, he is not like so many others who forgets his heritage. He is publishing manuscript stuff from Yemen. He's constantly citing the Yemenite authorities. That is actually significant. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that typically you find Yemenites and Moroccans and everything, they study in these Ashkenazi yeshivas, and unfortunately they forget about their past. All they want to do is become Ashkenazim. Some even went so far as to change their names. What happened was in the 1960s, early 70s, many traditional Yemenite, Moroccan, Tunisian Jews, they didn't want to send their kids to the secular schools, and they were convinced to send them to yeshivas. And what do they know? Ashkenazic, Sephardic, there weren't any Sephardic yeshivas really in Israel then. Oh yeah, it was Bar Yosef, but you didn't have like high school level yeshivas run by Sephardim. So they sent, and they didn't want to send them, they were convinced not to send them to the Mamachti Dati for whatever reason. And these were not Haredim at all, but they thought, they had this attitude that, the rabbis, Sephardim have a lot of respect for rabbis. Yemenites are not Sephardim, but they were put in together with the Sephardim. So when they come, they would come to these people and say, send your son to learn in our yeshiva. They sent them there. The problem was that these Haredi yeshivas uniformly denigrated the Sephardic approach. The Sephardic rabbis were not regarded as serious Torah scholars. And often what happened is that the people who came out of these yeshivas, they were embarrassed of their past. They didn't feel confident in their traditions. They became Ashkenazim, basically. And they had to become Ashkenazim because they were now in this Ashkenazi Haredi world, which maybe they felt lucky that it welcomed them and they sent their own kids to there. But they themselves could not find shiduchim if they didn't become like Ashkenazified. And their children certainly couldn't find shiduchim. And this continues to this day. The story has yet to be written about the discrimination and the uprooting of Sephardic culture among the Haredim. We know about in the secular world the way they treated the Sephardim. But the same thing happened. Ironically, Rav Shach, who more than anyone else opened up the gates of dispute in the Haredi world, before Rav Shach, you didn't have the terrible disputes, not just between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, but in the Haredi world itself, which continues to this day. I mean, just last week, a group of kids from the Peleg, two of them, confronted Rabbi Feivelson, he's a leading Musar authority in the mainstream Lithuanian world, with a knife. And they threatened him, if he doesn't stop teaching, there will be consequences. So, I mean, what's going on today, you can't even imagine. But Rav Shach, who was responsible for a lot of this because of his very strong approach on certain matters, he, Dafka, was a big defender of the Sephardim. And he fought against the discrimination of the Sephardim and fought to get them into yeshivas, but it didn't help that much. And the truth of the matter is, all this talk of Das Torah, it's very hard to break down these discriminations. So when I see a figure like Rav Ratzabi, who comes out of the Ashkenazic yeshivas and still is writing as a Yemenite, this is someone that I wanted to have a connection to. Now, what I mean by a connection to, and this answers one of the questions last week, there are very few people in the book that I have any personal relationship with, that is, that I went to speak to them personally. Some of them I did. But the others, I really don't have any desire to. It's almost like I decided to join, and through the book, it's a creation. I joined the Republic of Letters, I guess you could say. If you know the term Republic of Letters, in the 17th and the 18th century in Europe, you had the idea of the Republic of Letters, where people would intellectually correspond about important issues of the day. Well, we've had a Republic of Letters since medieval times. My interest in corresponding with Rav Ratzabi is simply in an intellectual Torah matter to hear his great insights. His politics, I couldn't care less. And I wouldn't even, you know, I don't even know if, you know, I'd be able to have a good conversation with him, because some of what he says, I'd find, like, just this page, by the way, you can look down. I got his picture, but it's Ratzabi saying, "I'm going to this actually put in Chayrim." So you're dealing with, but nevertheless, I don't like putting people in Chayrim, but he's an amazing person in terms of his learning and his way he's able to join, like, he's against going to the army, all these things. That's not my approach, but it's okay, because I'm just interested in the intellectual and the Torah correspondence, not the personal. So I never really had any desire to go meet him personally, like some of these figures. I'll tell you about some of them I have, just to connect in a certain way. And this Republic of Letters continued. By the 19th century, you had the Maskilim, their own Republic of Letters. You have the letters of Shir and Shaddal. The second half of this book is sort of moving in to that Republic of Letters. The first half is more traditional responsa. So there'll be a number of letters I have with Rav Ratzabi, and I'm very impressed by him. But again, it's the sort of, I'm very happy from the distance. Sometimes you wonder, you know, you meet the people. I met some of the rabbis. I've never had a problem speaking to them. But what I find amazing is, go on YouTube. For example, go look up Rav Vad Yosef when Rabbi Sheinberg came to see him, or Rabbi Vazer. Here are the greatest Torah scholars in the world. And they sit together, and this is on YouTube, and they have nothing to talk about. It's incredible. I don't know what to make of it. They don't have anything to say. All they do is give each other brachos. When I meet with these great rabbis, I immediately start asking them questions and asking to understand. There's a video also of Rav Mazuz coming to Lakewood. They brought him to Lakewood. He's sitting with the Rosh Hashiva of Malkiel, and they have nothing to talk about. It's like, I just find it interesting that people, even though they're great Torah scholars, such a different culture, they don't speak, but they speak in print. You see some of these people, they have Torah correspondence, but they can't shoot the breeze, let's say. They can't talk about matters, even can't talk Torah matters in person. Some people can't really speak in person. Everything has to be done through the pen. And others can't do it through the pen. They can only do it in person. We've had great Torah scholars who couldn't write Torah matters. In fact, Rav Shmuel Salant, not only they say he couldn't write, they say he physically couldn't write. I don't know how to square this with the fact that we have responsa that he wrote, which recently was published. But they say he himself literally could not write. So this is Rabbi Ratzabi. So who is Rabbi Ratzabi? Well, the Yemenite Jewish community, there really are three parts to the Yemenite Jewish community. In Yemen, you had the Baladi. They were the old traditional Yemenite Jews. They originally followed the Rambam. And then when the Shulchan Aruch came in, they adopted certain things in the Shulchan Aruch, but still a lot with the Rambam. And they also were influenced by Kabbalah. Then there are the Shami, who were much more influenced by by the Shulchan Aruch and by printed texts coming in. And they're pretty much today, I think, although the davening is different, they're pretty much culturally one community. And then there's another group. And the other group is called the Dardaim. What I'm going to tell you now, much of what I'm going to tell you is all about intellectuals. It's not about the masses. The masses, I think, today are not even aware of much of what I'm going to say, even though it split the entire community. Now, why do I say that? Because of the two groups, Rav Ratzabi is considered pretty much the leader of the Baal Adi, at least the halachic leader. And this individual, Rabbi Ratzon Arusi, that's his first name, Ratzon, Reish Sadi Vav Nun. Ashkenazi wouldn't have that. He's the Rav of Kiryat Ono. He's the member of the chief rabbinate, Mawetzet Rabbanut Harashit. He is also a PhD from Bar Ilan University. And he is the head of this group we're going to speak about now called the Dardaim, what remains of them. So why do I say it's people don't realize the masses? Because my son-in-law's family is in his mother's side is all Yemenite, and they all live in Kiryat Ono. So when they came in for the wedding, I tried to ask some questions, with the Dardaim, you live in Kiryat Ono, but they were like, they didn't know what I was talking about. Sometimes you have these disputes and the masses don't know. It's like someone pointed this out to me once, Rabbi Slifkin, who at this time should have been in South Africa, like I was supposed to be today in Rome, tomorrow start my trip. But on the internet, everyone knows the people who hate Slifkin, the people who support him. It's a big machlokas. Lo and behold, the average person I learned in your show has never heard of Rabbi Slifkin's, the dispute over Slifkin's book. He might know now about Slifkin because of his museum, but this has only took place among intellectuals and quasi-intellectuals online. But the dispute we're talking about, if you could go back into Yemen 150 years ago, the masses would know about it also. Who were the Dardai? A group of Yemenite Jews led by, this individual. Nope, I'll find him here. Here, Rav Yechiah Kafach, at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, created a revolution in Yemen, a return to the rationalism of the Rambam, a rejection of superstition and of Kabbalah. And that created a huge dispute which split the Yemenite Jewish community into really two. The Baal Adi and the Shami on one side, and the Dardaim on the others. His grandson was Rav Yosef Kafich. You see him here, the great scholar of the Rambam, who became the head of the Dardaim. That's together with his wife, Bracha. They are the only married couple to each win the Israel Prize. Rabbi Kafich won it for his Torah scholarship, and Mrs. Kafich won it for her, she created a big charity in Jerusalem. Today, the leader of the Dardaim is Rabbi Arusi, but they're really not the same group, the Dardaim, because if you go on the website, for instance, they ask about Kabbalah, Zohar. In Yemen, the Dardaim opposed Kabbalah completely. They opposed the Zohar. Rabbi Arusi says that, well, today we don't really oppose it. We understand it's part of the Jewish tradition. So he claims that there are no real Dardaim, which is not really true because there are plenty of people who are real Dardaim. And people have told me that he himself is a real Dardaim, but he has to publicly put on a more moderate face. So he's a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Kafach. Dardaim comes from a Dor Deah, or also there's a wise person mentioned in the Bible named Dardaa. They were called the Dardaim, and the opponents were called the Ikshim. Rabbi Ratzabi used to be a student of sorts of Rabbi Kafach, but somehow he repented, he would say, and he became a big opponent, and now all he does is badmouth Rabbi Kafach and badmouth the Dardaim. So that's obviously not something that I'm very happy with, but be that as it may, I wrote to him my question, because I said I was very attracted to this approach of bringing in the old Yemenite tradition, which is hardly known. And so that's the question. The answer itself is not is a typical halachic answer. You know, as I said, can you put it in deep freeze? You could save some money. And the conclusion is that yes, you can. if you, which you have to look at it, there's nothing wrong with an etrog that's old. There's no halacha that you buy a new etrog every year. The question is, if he says there's no kalim, you just have to look at it. If it still has its form and it doesn't have anything puzzle that developed on it, so fine. If the cold has not alboa griuta, hasn't caused a kilkul, has destroyed it. So if you have a beautiful esrog, like on that movie Ushpizin, remember that beautiful esrog there? Or if you got yourself a nice big Yemenite esrog, the giant ones where you can actually get it in Borough Park. There's one guy, he's a Yemenite guy, I don't know if he gets them shipped or he has them himself. He promised he wanted $300 for one. When I forgot the big ones. But you could, if you have a deep freeze and you want to put it there and it's good, the following year looks good, you can use the etrog again and again. There's no halacha that you have to buy a new etrog every year. So that is Rav Ratzavi. Now I'm going to take you Siman Lamed Beis. We got two more simyanim in Arachayim. I'm going to take you back to Morocco. And this time, however, we're not going to hear from Rabbi Sholem Misas. We're going to hear from his son. His son is, this is his son, Rav David Misas, who became, in fact, here in this picture, you see his father, his mother, and Rav David Misas. Rav David Misas, who passed away only about 7, 8 years ago, he wasn't that old, not long after his father, he became the chief rabbi of Paris, having grown up in Morocco, where French was his first language, because he grew up in Casablanca. In Meknes, where he was born, Arabic was still the language. Then in Casablanca, though, and as he got older, it became French. He grew up in the French system. He knew French, so he became the chief rabbi of Paris. He had a university degree. He also was given that picture you see where it says, this picture where you see my, where I'm showing you, he was given, like, that's where he appeared because he got this special legionnaire award that France gave him. But for many, many years, he was the chief rabbi of Paris, which is majority now, North African. You have Moroccan and Tunisian and Algerians. But having come from Morocco, he's someone who I could ask a question to. Unlike his father, Rav Sholem Misas, I never met him personally. And he never published any Sfarim. But he was a big Talmud Chacham. I wrote to him. Getting back to the old question we had before, if there were no synagogues for women, they didn't go to synagogue, and they didn't daven, what about reading Megillas Esther? I was wondering, did they actually hear Megillas Esther, or is this going to be another one of these things that we really can't explain it, but they didn't do it? Because we're going to see an example similar to that in just a minute. And I wouldn't have been at all surprised if he said that, no, the minhag was they didn't hear it, even though they have to hear it, because we have plenty of examples of this. I'll just give you one, which has nothing to do with what we're doing, but I wrote something about it recently, hasn't yet appeared. In Iraq, in Baghdad, women did not do kriya. They didn't rip tear a garment when a parent died, or a sibling, or a husband, or a husband. Because they said it wasn't snius. Now, how is that possible? It's a halacha. The halacha says you have to, but they didn't. And no one said that they should. They was taught that that's whatever it is. We have plenty of examples of practices and communities that coexist, even though they're in violation of open halachot. And sometimes the rabbis fight against it. Other times they try to say, well, you know, there must be some explanation. We don't understand it. And this, they just record the practice of not doing kriya. They don't really have a good reason. But as I recall, the Ben Ishchai, I'll check out the Ben Ishchai, I think he doesn't even try to change the practice. We have many such practices. We're going to see some as well. We're going to see some one in a minute. So I wrote to Rav David Misas. Often people in Israel pronounce it Mashash. It can come in Israel, but the name is really Misas. That's how it was pronounced in Morocco. So I asked him, what did they do with the Megillas Esther? Did they come to the synagogue? And did they hear the Megillah? In Gerba, since there's no place for the women in the synagogue, many of the women, they come to the courtyard. Every synagogue has, like, you go inside and there's a little courtyard, and then there's the synagogue itself. They could sit in the courtyard, and many at home. So he said to me, "I remember when I was in Meknes, which was a he says it's a Ir Yadua Biaduta. It's a city that's known for its Judaism, and they would call it Jerusalem of Morocco. When you come on the Morocco trip, although some of you have already been on the Morocco trip, I see, we will go to Meknes. We'll see the synagogue. We'll see. We'll talk a lot about Meknes." He says there was no place for women in the shuls, because they when they said there's no place today, they have a place for them, but there was no place. They didn't build a place for them. Their attitude was that synagogues are not for women. Synagogues are for men. Women are for other things. He says when we would return home, after the Suda of the Tzom, after the meal of the fast, what he's saying is that after reading the Megillah, they would have the meal at the synagogue to break the fast of Tanis Esther. Then we would read the bracha with for Megillah for the women. And also in the morning after Shacharis, we'd go home and read it for them. So women, of course, didn't go to shul. We would read it for them. Then he says, but in recent years, when they built new synagogues with Ezras Noshim, the women would come to the synagogue in Casablanca. They would hear the Megillah, but in most places they would hear it at home. He says, this is what I remember from my youth. I actually think he's misremembering, because he actually goes to Casablanca when he's 5 years old. So he's recalling Meknes, but we'll see that based upon what his father says, he couldn't be recalling Meknes. He's really recalling Casablanca. We're going to see just a minute that Meknes had a very strange minhag, another one of these anti-halachic minhagim. I mean, I hate to say anti-halachic, though, because this is the minhag in Meknes, and Meknes was an Ir V'Em B'Yisrael with great Torah scholars. Among the greatest Torah scholars there in Morocco were in Meknes. So we will see in a minute what I'm talking about. Actually, we'll see right now. Siman Lamed Gimel, the last section in Orachaim is the section, the Shulchan Aruch is divided into four sections. The first one, Or HaChaim, deals with, Shabbos and davening and everyday things. There's some strange things, though. No one is able to explain why it's not the Shulchan Aruch. It really goes back to the Torah. But so, for instance, tzedakah. If you and I were writing the Shulchan Aruch, we'd put tzedakah in Or HaChaim, Hilchos Tzedakah, Avelos. Avelos is part of everyday life. When someone dies, you sit Shiva. You'd think that would be in Or HaChaim. But whatever, for whatever reason, if anyone has a good reason for it, you can send it in the chat. But it seems that those areas fit in better with Or HaChaim than they do with Yoredeya. But and because of that, it used to be that some people, you learn all of Or HaChaim and you don't know some basic halachos. So the next responsum is from this individual. Showed him last week, young rabbi. I wrote to him in 2005. His name is Rafael Deluya. Deluya is a well-known Moroccan name. I wrote to him simply because he published this book, Zocher Brit Avot. It's all about the Minhagim of Morocco. There are many, many books on Minhagim of Morocco. I myself have about 10 different books, Minhagim of Morocco. One of the best, it's I think it's now four volumes, is written by Rabbi Lebhar. I think some of the listeners know him. He's now rabbi in Los Angeles. Before that, he was in Montreal. I think he was in Toronto also, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Lebhar. But he's a Moroccan, and he's so all about Minhagim. And why all these books? Because many of these books, Minhagim, really need to be justified because they appear to go against the Shulchan Aruch. So you have to justify them. Often the justification is that these minhagim existed before the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says in the introduction that if you have practices that already exist, don't change your practices because of me. And there are also many practices which people today look at, especially in the Moroccan community. In the introductions to many of these books, they talk about how people who come from Moroccan homes, they go to these Ashkenazi yeshivas and then they come home and tell their parents that what you're doing is wrong. You have to change it. And they're trying to say that, no, it's not wrong. This is our tradition. And it's based on important authorities and This gets back to the issue of not having confidence in their own traditions. So these books are often trying to justify the Moroccan practices. One of the big things that Sephardim don't do, and the Ashkenazi yeshivas have tried to destroy this, these Sephardic rabbis like Aravad Yosef pushed back against it, was the Yichud Room. The Yichud Room is only an Ashkenazic practice. No real Sephardi would ever do a Yichud Room at a wedding. In fact, it's regarded as an abomination because it's considered unsneistic to do the Yichud Room. And yet, the Ashkenazic Rosh Yeshiva have pushed the Sephardic students to do that. And so that's one of the big ones. Another one is Tzitzis. No Sephardi would have their Tzitzis out. You're not supposed to. The Ari already said that Rav Yitzchak Luria, tzitzis has to be inside. Tefillin are outside, tzitzis has to be inside. So you have all these people, they go to the Ashkenazi yeshivas and they tell them, we have to wear your tzitzis out. The Moroccan rabbis don't know what they're talking about. So you have books like this will explain why the Sephardic tradition is, Dafka, you wear the tzitzis in. And the list goes endless. If we're still in quarantine, God forbid, in another couple of years, we can go through all the different Moroccan practices. But this is Rav Ephraim Deluya. He was in the news just a couple months ago because he's one of the people, he's young. He wasn't a senior rabbi. No one's going to listen if he's the authority. The major rabbi was Rabbi Elia Abergel. Let me get his picture up right here. Let's see. He also has a son in Los Angeles. So Rabbi Elia Abergel is now maybe the senior, here he is, the senior really, him and Rabbi Amar are really the senior rabbis. He's an Av Beis Din in Jerusalem, preserves the Moroccan tradition, about 11 volumes, I think, by now, of responsa. He was the senior person. And so they wrote, they came out with the Zoom Psak before Pesach, a week or so before Pesach. If you recall, this Psak said, and it was specific, that for elderly people and for those who are going to be very depressed, if they have no family contact, you can have a Zoom Seder. I don't see how really this could have worked if you have a Zoom like I have, it stays on. Most people wouldn't realize it would go off after 40 minutes unless you have an account, like a real account. It goes off after 40 minutes, and I'm sure it would go bad or something. In any event, they did say that you could have a Zoom Seder. It was based on the Moroccan tradition that on Yom Tov, you can use electricity. In Morocco, everyone put on lights on Yom Tov. So if you can put on lights on Yom Tov, what's the problem setting up the Zoom Seder beforehand? You're not doing anything on you. It's just, it's broadcasting you, but you're not making any changes or anything on it, which, as I said, probably would have gone bad, or the screensaver would have come on. I don't know if it would have been such a great idea, but these were not Reform rabbis or conservative rabbis. These were great Torah scholars. And unfortunately, in the news, it was portrayed as if you're away from your family, you can do Zoom. That's not what it was. It was precisely for people who, especially elderly people, people who would be really depressed. They've never been away from their family. You have an old person, let's say your grandmother. She can't do a Seder on her own. How does she know how to do a Seder on her own? Or people who don't know what to do, they will be depressed. Then they gave the heter for. I know Rav Schechter, at least I'm told, was very opposed to this psak, but he gave another thing, which some people could say is just as crazy. He said, you can call them. He says, on Yom Tov, call your relatives that are by themselves. He said, no, he said, you don't need to do the Zoom Seder, but call. So he's on tape saying, on the RCA did a whole thing before Pesach. He says, call them. Actually, no. He said call them on a different time. On the RCA thing, he said to leave. They should leave their radio on Yom Tov. So they're not alone, but elsewhere, he said that if you think it's a problem, call them on the phone so that they don't, because it could be Pikuach Nefesh even for some of these people. In any event, that was the psak. We don't need to get into the Zoom psak. My sense is it really didn't take off, and probably for the best. There were even some very liberal modern Orthodox rabbis who said it's a big mistake. I think the problem also was that how do you put the genie back in the bottle? Once it's out this year, next year, what's it going to be? So you have an elderly relative who can't come for the Seder, so then you could also do it. So maybe they would say, yes, you're right. It isn't just for the Zoom. It's for any time you have someone who's stuck in a situation like that. But he's a reliable Rav and he's an expert in Moroccan practices. So I wrote to him about the same issue, Megillah. Same time that I wrote to Rav Masas. He points out that obviously there's an obligation for women to hear the Megillah. The question was, though, what about a bracha? He tells us that in Marrakesh, Marrakesh is the great city of Morocco. When you come on our tour, we'll be in Shabbos in Marrakesh. There's still a community in Marrakesh. Two shuls open every Shabbos. Houses you can eat. There's three houses that if you're a small group, you can eat there. Also a great Torah city, and Madonna even has a place there, and others. It's very exotic. But in Marrakesh, they didn't read with a bracha for the women. Why wouldn't you read for the women with a bracha? Hard to say. He doesn't know. He doesn't explain it. Also in the city of Sefrum, they also didn't read with a bracha. In Meknes, he tells us, they would read with a bracha, but just the first brachas, not the last brachas. Haravat Rivenu. Again, why? You have to look in the book to see if he comes up with some possible reasons. What he also tells us, and this is, if I'm not mistaken, this is not just in Morocco, this is elsewhere. The question was, what about the bracha? We make the bracha on Mikra Megillah, on the reading of the Megillah. However, in some places in Morocco, they held that you should make, when you made the bracha for the women, it should be Lishmoa Mikra Megillah, because they have an obligation to hear, not to read. I don't exactly know what that means, because what does that mean, an obligation to hear? If they don't hear, they have an obligation to read. Women can also read. But that was the tradition. So in some places, they read it differently. And then he says the same thing we saw, that in Morocco, they didn't come to synagogue at all. So they would read it for them in the house. But this is the interesting point, and this is why I say on page 60, the last paragraph, why Rav Dov Masas does not remember. Because, and this is testified to by his own father, Rav Shalom Masas, as well as in other sources, Rav Yosef Masas, that in Meknes, as well as other places in Morocco, women only heard the Megillah at night. They did not read the Megillah for them in the daytime, and they did not hear it during the daytime. Rav Yosef Masas has a response of dealing with this. It's trying to come up with some explanation. It's an opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. It's an opposition to the standard halacha that women need to hear the Megillah in the evening and in the morning. And yet I tell you, and in this great Torah city full of great Torah scholars and rabbis and halachists, women did not read the Megillah during the, and that was the minhag of the town. Women didn't read the Megillah, and they were never thought to be obligated to read the Megillah in the morning. And this probably predates, this could go back to the time the Spanish exiles came in. That predates the Shulchan Aruch. And that, although we don't have it in other Spanish diaspora places, but so here's an example of a practice which is apparently anti-halachic in quotes, because it goes against the Shulchan Aruch and it goes against the standard halacha. But this was the minhag in Meknes. That's why I said with David Messas, when he remembers as a child, he wasn't remembering, in my opinion, in Meknes in the morning. He was remembering in Casablanca reading for them in the morning, because in Meknes they didn't read for them in the morning, and there was no assumption that the women had to hear the Megillah in the morning. Ad Kan. Section Ora Chaim. Now we move into the next section of the book, Yoredeya. And the first question, in fact, let me, before we go on, I just I'd like to show you things. And I see I don't have the picture I want to show you. Let me see if I can just quickly pull it up. Yes, okay. Really, Ari Zivotofsky has to be given credit, but I'm going to show you a picture of Natan Slifkin in a minute. The question is, Ari Zivotofsky has a famous article on swordfish. Can you eat swordfish or not? In America, of course, no one eats swordfish. But I was interested in this for a long time, because I knew that Jews ate swordfish. Rav Chaim Benvenisti, the Knesset Agdola, speaks about the Dag HaCheriv. The Jews ate the Dag HaCheriv. So how did it happen that Jews stopped eating it? And the real reason, if you want to know the truth, is Rabbi Tendler. Chief Rabbinate gave hashgacha on swordfish into the 1970s. There's a letter of correspondence between Rabbi Unterman and Rabbi Tendler. And Rabbi Unterman's response with Rabbi Unterman explaining why swordfish is kosher, and Rabbi Tendler explaining why it's not. And they so they had the whole back and forth there. Rabbi Tendler was able to prevail in America. He was able to prevail eventually in Israel. In Italy, as of Rabbi Zivotofsky's article from about 7, 8 years ago, you could still get kosher swordfish. In other words, the rabbis there still said it's kosher, but pretty much it died out everywhere else, but not completely. So, for instance, at the Rabbi Zivotofsky had the halachic suda, and then Slifkin also had halachic suda, and they served swordfish. They served swordfish in Jerusalem under the hashgacha of the Jerusalem chief rabbinate. And as of a few years ago, you can still get it in Eilat under the hashgacha of the local rabbinate. Here's a, I just pulled up. Googled it. Here you see Rabbi Slifkin at his halachic suda with a swordfish. You see the swordfish right there? So they're serving swordfish. And you can do a lot of discussion about this. The issue is it does it considered scales or not? Although they, I think it's the Knesset Gedolah, he's the one who mentions that when the scales fall off when it comes out, that's really not the case. So it's but you don't what they have is something on it. Which it looks like a scale. In other words, Knesset Gedolah thought that most of the scale just fell off. I don't think that's the case at all. They say that there's the little thing. The question is it considered scales or not? And the problem was that no one ever saw a swordfish. But Tendler never saw it. And Isaac Cohen, who was a conservative halachist, never saw it. What they did is they each wrote to this expert. He was the world's expert at swordfish at the American Museum of Natural History. And based on their questions, he gave them answers. And based on that, Tendler ruled one way, and Isaac Cohen ruled another way. It was only when Ari Zivotofsky from the Boston Harbor was able to get a swordfish that they could bring it to the different poskim. None other than Rav Hirschl Schechter rules that swordfish is kosher. You can see this article from, he's online as well, in the Jewish press. He explains how Rabbi Tendler is wrong. Although he thinks Rabbi Tendler, what Rabbi Tendler did was good because he was able to shrug up the conservatives to show them that they have no business getting involved in matters of halacha. But the truth is, Rav Schechter says that the conservatives were right in this case, that a swordfish is kosher. And he ends l'maaseh, the conservatives were right in this issue. So a friend of mine is a rabbi in one of the areas with a vod there where they have a lot of restaurants, and Rav Schechter is the posek for all the vods, basically. All these are all YU rabbis, and he's the posek of the OU. So I asked my friend, does this mean that now all the restaurants in your area under the vod are going to be serving swordfish? Because the posek hador of America, the leading posek by far, no one even comes close. Has and for the modern Orthodox communities and the right-wing YU communities, I mean, he's like the Urim V'Tumim on Pesach, and he's ruled that swordfish is kosher. So now the answer is no, because it's already been like 50 years, and you can't get people to go back. It's almost like impossible. Maybe in Israel, if slowly they start doing it, people get used to it. But even Rav Hirschl Schechter is not the Pope. That even though he has said swordfish is kosher. The VODs and the OU, they have, for all this time, they can't really change their opinions. And Rav Schechter saying is not out of the blue. It's not crazy. He says it's the Rav's opinion also, because let me show you something. Oh, you got to find it now. In the 30s, the Agudas Rabbonim in America came up with a list of kosher fish. You see, it says sturgeon there. That's I marked it because I wrote about this. Sturgeon also was thought to be kosher based on the Nota Bihuda. The Nota Bihuda thought sturgeon was kosher. It was a huge machlokas in Central Europe in the late 18th century. But here you see in the mid 30s they were eating sturgeon. But look below it, swordfish is kosher on the Agudas Rabbanim, and this is in the 30s. So sometime in the 60s, due to Rabbi Tengler, my senses, we stopped eating swordfish and haven't eaten it since. Schechter also holds that pheasant is a kosher bird. No question, pheasant's a kosher bird. You can go to Israel and you can get pheasant. Zavitovsky has a picture of Kafach shechting it. Ramosha says he didn't want a mater pheasant because he says we don't know if the pheasant we have here is the same they ate in Europe. The name could be the same, but it could be a different bird. But we have Masover from Kafach and others looking at our pheasants saying, no, this is the bird we shechted. And that's how birds, that's how you know a bird is kosher, through tradition. So Rav Schechter holds, in fact, the rabbi of my shul, Rabbi Spivak, used to teach Shlita at YU, and he used pheasants. He told me he'd come to my house and he'd chuck the pheasant for me, do it in the bathtub, but my wife won't go for that, so I'm not going to have it. But so pheasant's a kosher bird as well. But as for sturgeon, look at this. In HaPardes, which was the rabbinic journal of all the Gedolim, here's an ad for sturgeon. See the pasuk there on the left describing it. And if you know Yiddish, it says here there's sword fish, there's sturgeon fish, gefinzich in the Rishima from the Gudas Rabbani. You find this in the list of the Gudas Rabbani for ein kosher and fish. It's a kosher fish. Was magman im essen. You can eat it. There's sturgeon fish is zer geschmack. It's very tasty. Und gut zu essen. It's good to eat. Dem sturgeon fish can men bekommen bei die. You can get it at Johnson smoked fish. Okay, so I wasn't asking though about sturgeon fish to the next question. The next question is to Rabbi Moshe Basri. Hold on, let me get the picture of, I don't have a picture of his father. Ezra, I wrote to his father, who is Rav Ezra Basri. Rav Ezra Basri is one of the leading rabbis from the Syrian community in Israel. Aleppo community, based in Jerusalem, another based in. There's a few different Batei Din in there. And I wanted to know, in Syria, did they eat swordfish? Because we know that in Turkey, they ate swordfish. We know that in North Africa, in some places in North Africa, in Gibraltar, there were people who ate swordfish. In Italy, they ate swordfish. So I wanted to know, did they eat swordfish in Syria? So he gave though my letter, we'll see later, a letter he sent to me, but he gave it to his son. I wrote to Rabbi Basri because he preserves also the Syrian minhagim, and he writes. When you want to find out these things, you have to write to people who write. He also was the chief rabbi of Spain for a period of time. Even though he lived in Israel, he would go back and forth to Spain. In his latest volume of Responsa, there was the same one that includes the letter to me that we'll see later in the semester. There's an amazing letter. I don't know if the person who wrote to him, because he included the letter that he received and also the letter that he replied, I don't know if the person would appreciate the fact that he's mentioned in the book. It's a guy writing from Yeshiva Town. I believe it was even Lakewood. I think it was Lakewood. Was it Muncie or Lakewood? I think it was Lakewood. In which he says that, you know, he's trying to be honest. He's trying to do the right thing, taxes and everything, but all around him, people are, you know, making it seem like he's crazy. And Rabbi Basri writes to him, encouraging him, don't listen to these so-called from people. They look pious and everything, but they're a bunch of phonies, etc. But here you have testimony from someone writing how he's showing that he's trying to be honest and just the culture around him is not in that respect. So it's quite interesting. And later on when I have the book, I can read some of it. But so the question is, the Minhag of Syria with the Kashrus of the Dag HaCheref. He begins by saying that he investigated it with the people who came from Aleph Reish Tzadi, Aram Sova. Aram Sova is the traditional way of saying Aleppo. I don't think there's anything left in Aleppo to see when we can go touring there one day. Everything's been destroyed. But he asked the Aleppo, that's the main communities. If you go into Brooklyn today, you go to Panama, you go to Mexico, it's really Aleppo. Yeah, you had Jews in Damascus. Professor Faour, who just passed away, he was from Damascus via Argentina. But Aleppo was really the center of the community, the ban on conversions, all the stuff you hear about the Syrians, it all comes out of Aleppo. And Aleppo had real extremism in Aleppo. In Aleppo, they burnt the Torah commentary of Eliyahu ben Amozit, one of my heroes. Aleppo had some real extremists there, not Damascus, Aleppo. Don't think that it's only Ashkenazim that have extremists. Art Scroll put out a book, even Sages or Scholars of Aleppo. And there's this wealthy guy in the Syrian community in Brooklyn. He funded Zvi Zohar, who's an academic expert on the Sephardic world, to write a critical review of it. Because as in typical art scroll fashion, they left out all sorts of interesting things that doesn't fit in with their approach. But he says he asked the people from Aleppo. And the problem with Aleppo is, he says, there weren't much fish there. Aleppo, you know, it's not on the water. There wasn't a lot of fish. And therefore, there are those who didn't even eat fish on Shabbos, and they don't even know what this fish was. And then he heard from this other rabbi, Yitzhak Safrani, that they ate other types of fish. He gave the names, but they did not eat the swordfish. And he says that some told me that in Aleppo, there was a certain fish with like pointy, but it wasn't the dag hacherev. Although, you really, if you can look at a fish and if it has this fins and scales, you can eat it. You don't need a tradition. Since there's debate sometimes exactly, is this a scale or not? If there's a tradition, you don't even need to ask. There might be some people now with us from South Africa. I know there's that issue in South Africa. I think it's what, a clapfish or something like that, where the Beis Din supports it, and there's a Haredi community there. They don't eat it, but they've been eating this forever in South Africa. And then he says, but look in the Knesset Gedolah, who says, Minat Pashut B'chol Yisrael. That means that everyone, all Jews, it's funny, he says, Minat Pashut. What he means is in the Ottoman Empire, the Judaism he knows, that everyone eats the Dag HaCherev. He said, oh, it is the Knesset Gedolah. He says, even though it doesn't have the scales, it's because when it comes out of the water, it doesn't, and he goes on. And then he just says that, you know, you can look in the Encyclopedia Talmudic, et cetera, et cetera. But, so the conclusion here is that if you're looking for a masorah, a tradition, you can't go to Syria. In Syria, they did not eat the swordfish. Simon Lamed Hay, and this I think will be the last one we do, or maybe not, a tshuva from 1989 to Rabbi Greenblatt. When I first started learning some Yoredeya, they had some issues. There's nothing here, no great chachamas, no great wisdom. I mean, they're interesting. But you don't need to ask Rabbi Greenblatt this. My question was as follows that I asked him. Someone who made all his money selling basar b'chalav, milk and meat. You're not supposed to get hanah from that. What does he do now? He became religious with all this money. And really, it's not even a, it's explicit when you're in Yoredeya, but it's, I didn't know this at the time, that you can't, basar b'chalav, you can't get hana, you can't sell it, you can't mekadesh a woman, but once you've already done it, the money is fine. So that's what he explains, and he goes into it a little. And then he talks about also the issue, let's say you own stock in a company, which is selling this, it's also not a problem. This is all people often ask, you have stock in the company, there's chametz, or that sells charfos and things like that, it's not an issue. Okay, well, time for one more, actually, because the next is Rav Hershel Schechter, one of the earliest things I hear. This dates from 1985, the beginning of 1985, so 35 years. This was the first letter I ever wrote to Rav Hershel Schechter when I was in BMT, a blessed memory. And I was learning certain things, and I didn't, in those days, he didn't even have a beard, but I didn't know, I just heard at YU, when you're at, well, BMT would have the people from Gruss. Gruss was a, I guess they still have it, though, where they would go to Israel for a year or two. Really, you could do your entire smicha there, but mostly it was guys that came from a year. They were now obligated to, but if you were in YU smicha then was 3 years. I think now it's 4 years, right? You'd go for 1 year in Gruss, and you learned Torah, Eretz Yisrael. It was a great experience. Guys would come with their wives, single. It was Rav Lichtenstein would give shiur there. Nachama Leibowitz gave shiur. Or Dovi Miller really ran it. I would always hear, it's the first time I heard really when I was in Israel, Schechter, he wasn't an international figure then, but I'm in the YU circles, even then as a young man. I think he's born in 38. So in 1985, he's not even, he's 40, 47. Already then he was, and that was a time when you had people like David Lifshitz. I mean, you had many other great people, but it seemed that the younger rabbis were always talking about Schechter. So I figured I had a question. Let me write to Schechter. In fact, I think so began the, with this letter began my foray into the letters, into this republic of letters that I've continued. I also have with the academic scholars. I have a whole list. For a while, I was doing with political figures. So what were my questions to Rav Schachter? This one is, it's interesting. And I didn't know at the time. He discusses it in one of his Torah articles. Rav Yosef Hoffman has a whole essay on it. There's a famous passage. It's quoted a few different places in the Sifrei. Rashi mentions it. Others, that Beis Din tells you, you have to listen to what Beis Din tells you. Even if they tell you, oh, yamin shu small. Even if the Beis Din tells you that was right is left and was left is right, you have to listen to what Beis Din says. They have the authority. The problem with this is that there's a whole Talmudic tractate, Masechet Horayot, Horius, as they call it in Yeshiva world, which the whole idea of it is that if the Beis Din makes a mistake, not only shouldn't you listen to it, you're not allowed to listen to it. Like if Beis Din were to get up today and say that they've concluded that, you know, pig is a kosher animal and they've been wrong all these years, you can't eat it. No, the Beis Din's wrong. Just because the Beis Din says, I'm going to say Beis Din, the Sanhedrin. If the Sanhedrin gets up and makes a declaration that that you know is wrong, you're not allowed to listen to them. The Rabbi Aryeh Klapper has a fascinating article about the Zakei Mamre. The Zakei Mamre is one who goes against what the Sanhedrin says. Not just goes against in theory, but goes against in practice. So if I'm a Torah scholar and the Sanhedrin rules one thing, I can teach my students that the Sanhedrin is wrong and that the next Sanhedrin will refute them. But I can't do is teach them in practice to say the Sanhedrin said that this is what you have to do, and I tell my students do otherwise. If I do that, then the Sanhedrin will warn me and say, you can't do that, this is our ruling. And if I continue to do that, I'm regarded as a Zakin Mamre, what they call a rebellious elder. And the punishment for rebellious elder is execution. So Rabbi Aryeh Klapper discusses this paradox here. Because if you're a Torah scholar, and you know the Sanhedrin's wrong, and you know in accordance with Masechet Horayot, not only are you not obligated to listen to them, you can't listen to them, and you have to teach your students, in accordance with Horayot, that they're wrong. And yet, by doing that, you're a Zakei Mamre. So he develops the idea that the Zakei Mamre is forced, because of his conscience, to lead to his own death, because he has no choice. In order to follow halacha, he has to teach that the Sanhedrin is wrong. And he has to teach that halacha maisa. The Sanhedrin says, you can now drink coffee on Yom Kippur. He has to teach that the Sanhedrin's wrong, even though he knows that that is going to make him a Zakein Mamre, and he is going to be executed. It's a paradox. Rabbi Klapper calls him the Gibur HaMasora, that we have to look at the Zakein Mamre, if he's like, as you know, in a positive way, that he is fighting for the truth as he sees fit and is willing to die for it. It's not the normal way we look at the Zakein Mamre. So, but this is a big problem, because how can you say if they tell you what's right is left and what's left is right, you have to listen to them? And the Ramban mentions this in Chumash also. The famous example is that Rabbi Gamliel tells Rabbi Yeshua they had a dispute over when, you know, the whole calendar, when's Rosh Hashanah, when's Yom Kippur, and Rabbi Gamliel makes Rabbi Yeshua violate his holiday to come to, was it Yom Kippur, I believe, right, or Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I forget, to come to him on that day. But the answer that's usually given is that that's different, that this only applies al yamin shu small when it comes to the calendar. But every other time, it doesn't. It's a problem. Rav Schachter believes that the expression al yamin shu small refers to if it's a case of sheval tase, that is, if they not if they tell you to do something, but if they tell you to refrain from doing something, then in that case you would listen to them. But if they tell you to actively do something, which you know they're wrong, then Masechet Horayot will come into play that you do not listen to them. Unless it's a matter, if you know that they're wrong on the calendar, you still have to listen to them. He calls attention to Rav David C. Hoffman. He has an essay on this in the Malamed Holio. There's a different version. Another version of the Midrash Halacha is not if they tell you what's right is left and what's right is right, but if they tell you what's right is right and what's left is left. In other words, you not that you think they're wrong, but they're actually right. That sort of thing. That's the first part of his letter. We'll finish up. It's quick. The second part of his letter is going into a church. I asked him about that, and he says absolutely forbidden. Okay, I get back to church in the next tshuva. We'll speak a great deal because the next tshuva is Rav Shalom Masas with a really groundbreaking, famous responsum. He became a famous responsum. Then I asked him about Pasakum, eating non-Jewish. You're traveling. You don't ever want to travel before you go to Europe after Israel. So can you have non-Jewish bread? And he says, well, if you're on traveling, you can. Today, though, I look at this and I say, this is strange because he's really giving a chumrah, I think. We all eat non-Jewish bread. We don't eat, except during maybe a Seres Yimei Tshuva, we assume that you can have pas palter, pas non-Jewish bread from a, unless he's assuming, I mean, that maybe pas palter, if it has hashgacha, it's no longer regarded as pas palter, even though the whole thing is made from a non-Jew. But maybe some we have a Dayan who's listening right now. Maybe you can illuminate this, because I always thought that pasakum, the non-Jew who makes it, just because you know it's kosher, a Jew has no involvement, it's still pasakum, but maybe not. And the last question, two questions I asked him quickly, was about the Megillas Esther. There's a commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos that the Ramban says there's a positive obligation to live in the land of Israel. And the Megillas Esther, that's the name of the commentary, says that no, there's no obligation to live in the land of Israel. The only obligation is in the days of the Second Temple there was, and in the days of the Messiah. And this is the Satmar Shita. The Satmar Rebbe likes to quote the Megillas Esther. So I wrote with some ha'aros, some comments on how difficult the view of the Megillas Esther is. It contradicts certain important texts we have. And he writes to me, Yafe katafta, very good. And he says, it's impossible to say what the Megillas Esther said. And finally, the last thing he said, I asked him about also, you go to a hotel and they serve, let's say, fruit, the fruit cup you want to have. Can you do that halachically? He gave an answer that I'm looking at it now. It seems to me this is not the minhag. He says that if you're going, if you're traveling, so you have it akrai, occasionally. And he says occasionally means one day in this hotel, one day in the other hotel, but you shouldn't have it twice in the same hotel. You shouldn't basically be eating in the non-kosher dining room, even if it's kosher stuff. My sense is that the Minhag Yisrael is not that if you're at a hotel for 5 days, even you go down, if there's fruit there, you take the fruit. I've seen this on our trips with big rabbis, and I'd want to ask him maybe once why. He says, well, only do it one day, but don't do it a second day, because if it's fruit, it's fruit. But that's what he holds. I actually think that this is a chumrah, not a coup at all. It's a real chumrah that he has here. But I don't know the source. When I see him next, maybe I'll ask him again why he's so makpid on not. I mean, from a Rabbani's perspective, there's no such thing as a non-kosher thing like this. There's kosher food and non-kosher food. If the food is kosher, you can eat it all you want. It's not. Okay, so we've gone long enough, I think, even over time. Next week, we're going to get into this question, the big question: can you assist, give charity for a Christian to build their church, for Christians to build their church? I'll talk about the context, what that was about. Two very long tshuvot from Rabbi Masas and Rabbi Yehuda Tzolk'in. Then we'll get more from Rabbi Ratzabi and others. And hopefully next week, I'll introduce you to one of the great Torah scholars of our time, Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, some of his interesting perspectives. So before I go up, I will. I just see that Mel comments that fruit is fine, but not cut fruit. The question was about fruit cup. I don't know what the difference is, cut fruit, and why is cut fruit not any different? Cut fruit is also not a problem. Everything's cold. And he's saying you can eat cut fruit. You go to the supermarket, you get a cut watermelon. It's not a problem. But he's saying only one time. Don't make a habit of sitting there. So I also understand why you don't make a habit sitting there. But I would think if you're traveling, two, three, four times is not making a habit. Remember, the Noda Yehuda says that travelers are in the status of bedieved. That travelers, anything that we usually regard as a bdiavad, travelers are in that. So travelers can do all sorts of things that regular people can't do. And I would think that, he says to eat one time in this hotel, one time in that hotel. The problem is, though, you're at the hotel for 3 days. So if you're at every day a different hotel, I get it. But if you're at the hotel, the same hotel for 3 days, it's an interesting, it could be he's speaking in terms of he's not basing it on Yoredei HaLacha, but on sort of like mixing with the non-Jews, mixing with non-kosher. And that might make a distinction also if you're there as a group. You know, when we go in my tours, we're as an entire group. So we're on the, it's a whole different situation. So I don't know. This is something that I need to clarify further. I've told a few people about, and they're not really sure as to what the just the logic is. And every time I see him, I forget to ask him. So, okay. Ellen says that the judge was Rabbi Shubo's brother. It may even be that a relationship started in the opposite direction. Oh, the judge in Rabbi Soloveitch's case. Barry says, when Rabbi Shubo was nifter, the Rav stood outside the shul in a pouring rain to attend the levaya. Rabbi Shubo was hakaret hatov. Yes, he couldn't go in the synagogue, the sanctuary for the funeral, so he stood outside. L'havdil, when Rabbi Ram passed away, one of the rabbanim from the Washington Heights community, he stood outside because, God forbid, he couldn't go into YU for the funeral, because YU is like in Cheirim for some of these people. So instead, he stood outside. Is Rav Yitzhak Ratzabi the brother of Ratzon Ratzabi, the Mishpat Ivri expert? I don't know. I don't know. It's not a completely uncommon name, but I don't know. Baruch says, when I said Sephardic rabbis are not regarded as serious Torah scholars, did they rip out the Rif, the Rashba, etc., from the bookshelves? No. But everyone from the Chida and on, they weren't. Everyone knows that the Rambam's a great Torah scholar in the Rif. The point is, though, they don't think that in the last few hundred years the Sephardim have anyone to measure up. There's even the joke that the Rambam comes back and tells Reb Chaim his question and his answer is all wrong, and Reb Chaim says, what do you expect from a Sephardi? But that's obviously a joke. In the yeshiva world today, the canon does not include any Sephardim of the last few hundred years. Even the Chida is not included in the canon of the mainstream world. It's you really have to stop maybe the Shulchan Aruch, the Radbaz. After that, it's not part of the canon. Why would Rav Ratzabi want to put Amnon Yitzchak in Cheirim? This goes back to during the elections, when Amnon Yitzchak created his own party, which everyone knew was never going to make enough get enough seats to get in. So the point was, and Rav Ratzabi was not the only one. Rav Yosef also cursed him that he's going to hurt the Shas party by creating his own party. It's just going to take away votes. So from my perspective, it's a terrible thing. You're having a political dispute and someone is michutz l'machane, out of the fold, because he doesn't fall in line for political reasons. That's why, by the way, Rav Shmuel Auerbach, whose politics I find abhorrent, and the whole movement, the Peleg. But when Reb Chaim Kanievsky said he's a Zakeh Mamre, and when he said that anyone who follows Rav Shmuel Auerbach can't get an aliyah in shul and can't be read the Torah, and their children need to be thrown out of schools. This is all because of a political thing. The Rav Shmuel Auerbach decided not to follow the politics. I don't see how you can, there should be a separation, Torah and politics. I feel it's very unfair. You might not agree with Rav Shmuel Auerbach's politics, but all of a sudden now you can shofech et damo, as they say, because he decides he doesn't want to listen to Rabbi Steinman. And I say that even though everything that Rav Auerbach's followers have done is terrible. But yet, they have the right to do that without being considered completely out of the fold, I would think. Baruch was trying to illustrate the absurdity of our dear Dr. Shapiro's words as formulated. I think, Reb Baruch, my good friend, that everyone understood when I said that the Sfaradim don't count. They weren't referring to the Rambam and the Rif and the Ran and all those great sages. They're referring to the contemporary rabbis. The Aguda, they wanted to bring in all these Sfardim, so they had to put in a token Sfardi, Gadol. So they put in, I think it was Rav Ezra Tia from Poret Yosef, and after one or two sessions, he decided he's not going anymore, because the sessions were all in Yiddish. Can you imagine? They put in the token Sfardi Gadol, and yet they still have the sessions in Yiddish. That's why Chacham Avad Yosef finally decided that we don't need this anymore. We can make our own party. And they formed the Shas party, and You confused Mistook or Rusi. Yes, Rabbi Lepar was in Toronto. Those who read Hebrew and are interested in Moroccan material, Rabbi Lepar is really one of the world's experts in the traditions of Morocco. Why does Sephardim go to Ashkenazi yeshivas? Why are they clamoring for entrance to them? Masochism? No, because they've been convinced that that's the height of Torah learning. And for a while, the truth is, it was the height of Torah learning. There weren't any Sephardic yeshivas, so if you wanted advanced Torah learning, you had to go there. The problem was that there's culture and there's Torah. The culture of these institutions put a lot of pressure on them to get rid of their Sephardic backgrounds, their traditions. The Torah, they were going there for the Torah, supposedly, but together with it, it also, Rav Mazuz is strong about this. And even some of the Sephardic Gedolim, Rav Chacham Avad Yosef, who did so much to turn this around, he sent his kids to Ashkenazic yeshivot. Why he didn't send his kids to Porat Yosef, that's a different reason. So someone texted that the difference is, I asked about why certain things are not in Yoredeia. He says, Orach Chaim is what happens every day, Shabbos and holidays. It has a set time. Yoredeia happens at no specific time. So Avelos, mourning, it happens when it happens. And Tzedakah, that works for Avelos. That person figured Tzedakah also. Tzedakah, I think, would go. Shmuley says he doesn't think the Yichud Room is an old Ashkenazi custom. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how far back the Yichud Room. Baruch, why don't Sephardim go to their own yeshivas? Today they've started to. That's the Shas Revolution. If you saw Chacham Avadia Yosef's funeral, you saw tens of thousands of Sephardic yeshiva bachrim. That's all in the space of two generations. Now they do go, many of them. They're in the Sephardic world now, you have two types of Sephardi Haredim. You have Sephardi Haredim, who are really Ashkenazi, part of the Ashkenazi world, and they take their orders from the Ashkenazic elite. And then but now we have real Sephardic institutions. But this is all, this is due. And Baruch also says maybe the Sephardic Derech HaLimud is better in some ways. You know, that's what Rav Mazuz says, that our way is better. And yeah, the Ari was half and half. He had both. Someone asked what happened to Evan Ezer. Evan Ezer comes after Yoredeia. We're going to get to Evan Ezer. Yes, Rabbi Klein wrote, if you look in Rabbi Klein's book, he has more than one book, but his book, Halachic Studies or something like that, he talks about the swordfish. Hyman says that Rav Schechter has also weighed in and asserted that the swordfish is definitely kosher. Yes, we got to that, but nods of Tenor saying that his heart was in the right place. Exactly. And that's what I posted. How many Posek Hadors are there? Good question. I don't know. What was Rosh Tenor's basis for ushering swordfish? He thought that there's no scales. Rav Soloveitchik, according to Professor Sternberg, Rav Soloveitchik ruled that swordfish is kosher. Rav Savitsky, who was, we mentioned him last class, and Rav Soloveitchik's adversary in the early years, although later they got together. Rav Savitsky once, I heard this from his son, Rav Moshe Savitsky, not the Rosh Yeshiva here. There's a son named Moshe who's a rabbi in Flatbush. His brother is the Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vadas that we mentioned a few classes ago. But I heard from Rabbi Moshe Savitsky that Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, or Shabbos Shuvah, I forget which one, Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky declared that swordfish is kosher, that he had been to the Boston Harbor. He checked it out, it was absolutely kosher. But his wife, the Rebbetzin, I heard from the son, refused to allow it in the house. Most people in Lakewood these days eat only parsley sirloin. I mean, because you have it there. Everyone assumes that if you can get regular kosher parsley sirloin, you shouldn't eat pasakum. The question is, let's say the pasakum is cheaper. Then you can, but if it's the same price or almost the same, everyone says you should get it. There's a heter to eat pas halter. So Hyman says the paspalter is heter is commercially baked bread. Pasakum, you're saying, but what's a bakery? Bakery, we assume, is paspalter. I guess that's commercially baked bread as well. But the question I asked Rav Schechter was, I'll show it to you. It was precisely about when you're traveling. He says, Pasakum, imein b'chashash treifus, imu paspalter, mutzas b'shasat chakun, tsei ha'baderech. So he's saying, Rav Schechter is saying that only as a traveler, because you're like in this idea of a situation. So if you're a traveler, you go to this bakery and you can eat it if it's kosher. But normally, if you're home, you wouldn't. But how does that paspalter, the bread that we eat, is paspalter, isn't it? You go to a bakery, it's a non-Jewish bakery, it's under hashgacha. I guess hashgacha makes it not paspalter. It makes it pas Yisrael. Is that the svara? In France, everyone, including the Haredim, eat these big breads that you buy on the street because they're all known to be kosher. Those are all paspalter. The Gra is strict on this. I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head that with hashgacha, maybe you'll say it's not considered paspalter because the hashgacha makes it sort of like a pas Yisrael because a lot of the bakeries are non-Jewish bakeries under hashgacha. A couple other things. So Hyman says pas Yisrael requires simply that a Jew light the oven, at least for Ashkenazim. The problem is that all these breads, you have plenty of bakeries, which the Jew doesn't do that, and we give hashgacha to them, and you get commercial bread products the Jew doesn't light the oven. And we assume those are pasakum. So they say you shouldn't eat these breads. You buy Arnold's bread or whatever it is during a Aseres Yemei Teshuva, you should only buy the Jewish bread. But Rav Schachter was saying that only when you're on the path. So does that mean that Rav Schachter holds that normally you can't buy all these OU breads in the supermarket because those are paspalter? And the heter is that you can buy them because they're cheaper or because they're more available. They're easier. If you're living in my town, you don't have to go all the way down to Lakewood to go to the supermarket to get the Cicero. Jennifer Badani says, cut fruit doesn't sit right with me. Well, I don't know what to say. There's no problem with cut fruit. They asked Rav Yashav. There are other people that didn't sit right with him. They asked him about these cut watermelons in the supermarket. And he said, it's not a problem. What could the problem be? So you're going to say, well, they used it to, this is in, it's in the book, actually, Rabbi Forth's book on kashrus. You're going to say they use it to cut the non-kosher stuff. And Rav Yashav's response was, you can be sure that after cutting it, they're going to clean it off. Who stood outside of Ram's front row? You can ask me privately. The Chidah and the Ben Ishchai, they were not taken seriously in the Ashkenazi Yeshivas, never. Chidah, from a Kabbalistic theme, it's always holy, but never his works are never cited, and the Ben Ishchai was never cited or studied either. Is it feasible to assume that a response given is from Naftali in 1985-86, 35 years ago, may no longer be correct? Yeah, sure, it's possible. I just saw the other day that Rav Avad Yosef's grandson writes that you can't rely on what his grandfather says about going in a Shabbos elevator because the technologies change. So it's definitely in certain cases, but other cases, I mean, it depends on the circumstance. If it's a question where it doesn't really change, if it deals with technology, and also I would say the questions that deal with meta halacha, sort of questions I was given at Brandeis, if it's a completely new environment and a new clientele, you could say it's not the same issue. So the response from the Rechiach of Weinberg when he's 1950s France, that's not the same in 1980s France, where they're very religious. In the 1950s, it was to find Shomer Shabbos was not so simple. So obviously that changed. Take the example, Naftali says, of wearing a yarmulke in the workplace. Many of us were told we could work without a yarmulke in the office. I wonder if today we would get the same heter. It's interesting you use the word heter on the assumption that you need a heter. If you came from Germany or you came from the Sephardic lands, you knew in Aleppo, they didn't wear a yarmulke. It was just understood they didn't. Today, no one who works in New York, you can work in a top New York law firm and wear a yarmulke. I don't think it's a problem. But on the other hand, I know someone who works in a law firm and he's very religious, but he doesn't, he's someone who learns every day, but he doesn't want to be seen as he doesn't want to be judged as a Jew. He doesn't want, if he makes a mistake, they do that. So there's all sorts of reasons. What I'm interested in, as you say, if you get the same heter, this idea that you even need to get a heter to wear a yarmulke, not to wear a yarmulke. And growing up, everyone knew that if you went to work, you didn't need to wear it. It's a nice thing if you did. Hyman laments that his son-in-law, a Persian, speaks, learns, and wears a fedora like an Ashkenazi instead of a fez. Okay. Okay, so Hyman's saying if it's kosher, it's still pasakum, but we're not noheg, like Rav Schechter said. All of us, basically, buy stuff in the supermarket. We go to bakeries that are under, you go to a bagel store, which is owned by a non-Jew, it's under hashgacha. You find these everywhere. Jennifer says, what about Ethiopian Jews who eat chicken with dairy? This is a problem, and Rav Schechter is going to deal with it. I asked him about this question. Not in this, in a future letter. What about the Ethiopians who don't know about some of the takanot in the Gemara? We'll talk about Rav Schechter, and we'll talk about the book that came out a couple of years ago by this Ethiopian rabbi who studied at Haaretz Sion, which has an approbation from Menachem Rabinovich, and he makes the case that Ethiopians don't need to be bound by mainstream halacha because of their tradition. Something which Rav Schechter absolutely rejects, and I find it hard to accept this Ethiopian rabbi's position that because they didn't know about things, that this is, quote, a minhag. But we'll get into that. It's an excellent question. Okay. Naftali, coming from Washington Heights, they even asked in 1975. That's interesting. Washington Heights is a very halachic community, but the practice in Germany, no one wore a yarmulke to go to work. No one in Frankfurt. There was never any assumption that you would. You say 75. You can still see in 1975, Rav Nebensal's father. He was on the Agronaut Commission. That was around 75, and you still see him in pictures there without wearing a yarmulke. And he was a frum yeki. So it's interesting that even 75, they would. Thought that you need to ask the question. But obviously, and I'll end with this, Naftali's point is correct that some questions, of course, only apply to the context of the time and the situation you're in. We will get into some of them. We've gone long today. Thank you very much. Again, I'll leave it now to our wonderful host, Rabbi Kelman, with some announcements, right?
Oh, announcements. We announced earlier. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Tomorrow morning, Marty Lection, Tanakh. You read the emails. That's all the announcements. So I announced before. But thank you. I said you go for an hour full and then you take the questions as long as it takes. That's we appreciate that greatly, that the extra time you're always willing to spend to answer all questions. And I think everybody here appreciates it. And all
And of
the
course, not everyone needs to agree, but I give you my perspective. And
Yep.
I love Baruch. You can keep fighting with me in the comments. I love it. So, and everyone else, thank you very much for the questions and,